This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, unburdened with duties, and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm, wise and skillful, not proud and demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove, wishing in gladness and in safety, may all beings be happy, whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be happy. Let none deceive another, or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another, even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings, radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outward and unbounded, free from hatred and ill will, whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness. One should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding, by not holding to false views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is now born again into this world. Sad. So the first of all, the thing that came up today at lunch was forgiveness. When I was giving a little talk at lunch, and because that mind, I often talk about generosity. Generosity is however little acts of generosity are, like as a monk, we have even the rinsing water from our bowls, we offer to the insects and to the animals and this kind of thing. And so that's just always having a mind that's trying to give and help out. And the Sangha wouldn't be supported without giving, so giving is an important thing. But also that mind, that comes with the level of renunciation, because, as the Buddha said, people, you've got to work by the sweat of your brow, to make your money and make a living. And then to go out and give on top of that is a difficult thing to do. And so, the Buddha described these things in great detail. I think it's because it's a form of renunciation as well. So it's starting with coarse things, And so our attachment to money, our attachment to the material things, all the difficulty that people go through having to get those things, to then go and actually give from that, you know, it's a difficult thing to do. And I think that's also why he established the Sangha, because it's like a law of karma. So, you know, if a being becomes enlightened, you know, they have to ordain and they have to live off the food and the requisites that are given by the lay community. Because it's just this karmic law that if any being was truly enlightened, you know, they would understand that their life, you know, has to be an object that people can make merit from. You know, couldn't be any other way. And so that's why the Buddha set up the Sangha the way that he did. But on the other side of generosity, I think another thing is to look at is forgiveness. Because this is where we're starting to look into our mind. And so when we forgive, and basically any time any thoughts come up in our mind that are negative towards another being, you know, we're judging a being's speech, or we're judging a being's bodily action, something of the past, or something from our memory, or something we're concocting in our mind, these are all opportunities for us to forgive. And so, you know, trying to get in a habit that we never go to bed with angry thoughts towards anybody. And so this is a more refined form of giving, giving up renunciation. This is, you know, giving up of our bad moods and our bad mental states. And I was mentioning that years ago I did a thing where I had a notepad, and so any thought, any critical speech I started with, is, you notice, like gossip and critical speech and these kind of things, it's very coarse. So first we can see these things in our speech. So I had a little notepad, and each day now I marked a bit of paper each time I said something critical with the mind of irritation or hate. I think it was about 5 or 10 times a day I was saying things. And this is when I was a junior monk. And so I realized, oh, you know, this is actually quite a problem. And then within about a week or two, I got it down to zero by focusing on it each day. And then I did the same process with thoughts. And I saw there was about 10 or 15 thoughts still lingering in the mind each day, and where I would be complaining about, you know, this person did this, or this wasn't right, and and all these kind of things. And then I realized that, you know, this complaining mind, this criticizing mind, you know, it's just as bad as that speech. It's coming from a mind of hate. It's coming from a mind of judgment. And really, you know, the Buddha taught us, if somebody does something bad with their body, then we look at their speech. Somebody does something bad with their speech, then we look at their bodily actions. If they do bad things with both their bodily actions and their speech, then we have equanimity. And, you know, we just go off and practice on our own. Because the practice occurs in our own heart. You know, we can't practice for anybody else. People can't even practice for their husbands and wives. The number one people they want to change. But, you know, all the time you just look in the mirror, and there's always something we can do. And so this is when I refer to that before we do something, while we do something, after we do something, whether speech or thought or bodily action, we have an opportunity to reflect, you know, was this a good action? Was this wholesome? Was this skillful? Was this wise? Or was there a better way of doing it? And so when the Buddha says live in the present, he doesn't mean live in the present in ignorance. He means, you know, live wisely in the present, because we're the owner of our actions. You know, our actions, we're born from our actions, related to our actions. We have our actions as our refuge. And so, you know, we have to be careful of this inheritance. So every day, you know, that simile I've said in the past, which is from the Dhammapada, it's like a jug filling drip by drip. So we have the jug. It's either going to fill with evil actions and overflow it. It's going to fill with good actions and overflow. And so it doesn't mean, you know, we're not going to be foolish and we're not going to do stupid things, but it means every now and then we need to reflect on our actions. And we go, okay, well, these ones were foolish. These were stupid. These were outright bad. and these ones were good. You know, these ones to be encouraged, these ones were wise, these ones taking me in the right direction. Like meditation, you know, like associating with good people, like encouraging ourselves to do things that are difficult, go against the grain. And so when we have these moments, then we're gathering towards what is good. So it doesn't matter that we're still stuck in some foolishness and ignorance, because we're moving in the right direction. And so we're starting to gather towards that. But if we just let the mind do whatever it wants without ever reflecting, then the mind tends to decay. You know, it's like all conditions, you know, they tend to get worse, not better. And so the mind is something that can be trained. And, you know, it doesn't matter wherever we're at in our practice. You know, we just have to be honest with ourselves. And maybe we have some spiritual friends, and, you know, we show, or people we're close to in our lives. And then we show ourselves as we actually are, because then that helps us to grow as a person. So we're not hiding any parts of ourselves. Doesn't mean we've got to go around telling everybody about everything, but it just means that we're honest. You know, when we have some coarse fault, you know, we can still talk about that with people. And because this encourages us to change, because we're embarrassing our defining ones, you know. So whether we're an angry person or a lazy person or a greedy person or an arrogant person or whatever, you know, that trait is that comes up in the mind, and while we're yet to deal with that, you know, this is why it's important to associate with people that help us, you know, move in the right direction. Because otherwise, you know, another day, another week, another month, another year, another decade, another life. So that was the thought that came on forgiveness, because, you know, even to the monks, I remember there was one teaching I read the other day, I've never read before, and this, I think this, what is it that howls, what animal howls, I forget, jackal howling in the distance, and then the Buddha said, you know, even that jackal has a little bit of gratefulness and goodness in him, but there's one bhikkhu here who doesn't have any gratefulness and goodness in him. Meaning, you know, we need to know how to, when somebody gives something to us, when people are kind to us, we need to know how to reflect on that. We need to know how to appreciate that. We, you know how to count our blessings, know how to understand, you know, when good things have been done. Because if we can't do that, then, you know, those people are giving and we're not actually accepting that. You know, it doesn't have to be material goods, it can just be, well, often it is material goods when somebody gives a gift or says, but it could just be, you know, them supporting us in some way. And so this is where we train our mind to think in good ways, because thankfulness and gratitude are very profound qualities of the heart. And so if we not naturally have those thoughts, then we need to teach ourselves, you know, to think that way. And so maybe it just starts with one thought in a day. You know, where I've had these little sheets that I've created over the years, you know, with little check boxes on them, with, you know, things to reflect on in a day. And so to help overcome some of my blind spots and areas that, you know, without those things, for example, if I didn't have certain reflections, then I don't have like inspiration or energy in my practice. Or if I didn't do a certain meditation, then maybe, you know, I would get tired. And so I had these checklists, and one of them says, you know, what good has been done today? So that's learning to reflect on your own good actions. You know, how have we grown in this day? But then beyond that, obviously, like as a monk, when people give us food and these kind of things, we're setting up our minds to totally accept that giving, you know, so we're totally there at that moment, you know, with our mindfulness, with our presence of mind, and so the act of giving is at its highest when that occurs. And then the giver, when they're giving, you know, they shouldn't be talking and shouldn't be doing this, and the receiver shouldn't be talking and doing other things, and you're just focused on that single act. Because then it's like the highest karma, because karma is action, but then action has levels based on intention. And so how can the intention be the highest if we're not truly mindful, if we're not truly present? So So that's, and then the last thing I wanted to discuss was the teaching of the Buddha. And so this is a bit of a deep teaching. It's called the five Panchakandas. So this is called the five groups of clinging. And so the Buddha has a few ways of describing the universe, like the world, as he calls it. And in Buddhism, when we're talking about the world of our own experience. So there's the world of like the six elements, earth, water, fire, wind, space, consciousness. Or there's the ayatana, which is like the eyes, ears, nose, tongue, body, mind, sight, sound, smell, taste, touch, thought. And then also another version of that, which has the six types of consciousness. And so anyway, so there's different ways of looking at it. And one of them is called the five khandas. And these arise, you know, so say you have a sight and the eye and eye consciousness. When they create contact, you have feeling right there, you know, and you have consciousness, which is colored by experience that is right there as well. And you have perceptions, which you're reacting to, which are like the labels. And so the Buddha neatly broke this down into five groups that we cling to. And the first is form. So this is usually like our bodies and other people's bodies, but it's also the four elements. So think of all the things that we have desire for in our life. It's like food and clothing and houses and holidays. It's all associated with form. You know, so it's all the four elements. Earth, water, fire, wind. And it's all changing. And we know with modern science, one day this earth will burn up in the sun, so it's not going to be here forever. And so this is the first group that we cling to. And it's a problem because we, particularly the bodies we cling to. And so when a lot of people, when they die, they have a lot of suffering because it's the first time they've ever contemplated death. They've ever seen that actually, you know, everything that comes together falls apart. You know, that's its nature. And so the Buddha teaches us that, yes, clinging to this with greed, hatred, and delusion, this is a problem. You know, we identify this as self, or that as self, or belonging to a self, or themself, and this gives rise to suffering. And then the next group is feeling. And so feeling are the three types of feelings. Then you have feelings of happiness, which is sukha, feelings of suffering, which is dukkha, and feelings which are neither suffering nor happiness, which is adukkha, asukha. And so, you know, all the moods that we have, everything that we experience, all the range of emotions, the Buddha just boils down to those three feelings, all the racking feelings we may experience in the body. The Buddha just simplifies it down to those three things. And he teaches us that even clinging to happiness is suffering. For example, in Buddhism you have the Brahma gods, and say a Brahma god will live for the whole existence of a universe, and even the formless period, maybe, I don't know. So an incredibly long period of time. And so they have a tendency to think that things are permanent, and they're experiencing feelings of happiness because they're in a heavenly body. Yet one day that happiness will come to an end. You know, one day that body, that form that they're in, that existence that they're in, that label that they have, comes to an end. And so the Buddha taught us that even the most refined forms of happiness will come to an end. Or it's just like a dinner. You may sit down and eating a beautiful dinner. 1 minute they're there, the next minute it's gone. You know? And all the suffering that went to the farmers and the people at the shops and everything to get that food onto your plate, let alone cooking it and working for it, and it's gone. And so this is where we can investigate, and we see, you know, these things arise, but we don't have to cling to them. You know? So this is the difference, where the clinging is what's causing the suffering. Because if you really, really want that food again the next day and it's not in the shops, and then you really, really want it, you're going to suffer, aren't you? or if you die and you really, really want your body not to have died in that accident or whatever happened, then in that state, you're really going to suffer because you can't get what you want at that time. And so we can apply this to anything in our life. And we just see this is where we see that, you know, we have to hold both these things. Ajahn Chah said it's like, you know, suffering is like grabbing the head of the snake and you get bitten. Where happiness is like grabbing the tail of the snake and it swings around and bites you anyway. So the happiness is the more difficult one to see. And usually when we're happy, we don't want to think about suffering. You know, so this is why most people in the world, you know, because they're immersed in materialism and sensuality, now are interested in spiritual practice. You know, and this is, of the last 92 universes, this is one of the most dense universes. This is the Buddha with the least disciples. So the amount of people on earth who are interested in spiritual practice and have wisdom are very few. It doesn't mean that people who are interested can't still practice. Just because the Buddha has died, his teachings are still here. And why I spend more time on the feelings is basically our clinging, our adherence to these feelings is at the source of all of our suffering. You know, so happiness, suffering, and ignorance of everything in between. And this, eventually, when we practice a lot, you know, this is a very, very deep teaching. And then the next one, which is also very deep, is the, in English they translate it as perception. But I like to call it labels of recognition. In Thailand, they tend to translate it as memory. So it's our memory that creates labels that we recognize. So it's like, this is Kasapa, that's a person, this is carpet, that's a house. And then suddenly we come along and the house is burnt down, now it's ash. And we suffer because the label house doesn't exist anymore. But was the house ever the house? Was it really your house? Or was it the ant's house? Or was it the mice's house? Or was it the ghost's house? You know, whose house was it? Or was it just a bunch of elements? And so this is like, you know, we need conventional reality to live. We need labels to live. Otherwise it'd be very difficult, you know, with 7 billion people on the planet to, without anybody having a name. So we need it to work. We need it to understand things. But the point is, we understand that the perceptions are like a mirage, like on a hot day in the desert. You know, you see something, you have to ask yourself, is it really there, or am I just seeing a mirage? Because, you know, it's a very, very hot day, and I could just be seeing things. And that's what we have to remember with these labels. Because just think of, you know, when we think about ourselves, oh, that was me in the past when I was a baby. And that's me now. But we're very, very different beings with very, very different mental states. So we have the similar tendencies that we've carried forward. And we have, you know, the chain of karma. But we're actually incredibly different. So it's the labels that we're clinging to that are causing us to identify to these things. And then you have volition. So volition is, so we've been talking about action. So action is karma, vipaka is result. So you have action and its result. And then volition is the moment that we create that action. So volition comes with intention. So volition is volition of body. It's when we decide to move the body or do something with the body or not do something with the body. Volition of speech, when we decide to speak, and then maybe also internal speech, and then volition of thought, and that may include internal speech, I don't know, but that's where we incline the mind towards things, to think things. So the mind is forerunner of everything. There are three types of volition. And this is probably our strongest form of I-making, self-making. And so the Buddha said it's like somebody who's going to chop down a tree. You know, they want to make a house or something, and so they need heartwood. So they're going to go chop down some big old tree with some beautiful heartwood. And instead they come along and they chop down a plantain tree, like a banana tree. And then they roll it out and it's just like cardboard. There's nothing there. And as many plantain trees as they chop down, they're just going to reap weariness. There's no heartwood there. They can't build anything out of it. It has no lasting use. And so this is like our volitions. Yes, you know, our volition and karma is very important, but there's no lasting essence in there. Now, as much good karma as we do, eventually those results will become exhausted. So this is why the Buddha teaches us to apply ourselves to the Eightfold Path, because this will create us, you know, a means of actually overcoming our suffering and actually like becoming enlightened and overcoming whatever difficulties we have. So it's like having a noble mind, a noble friendship, and noble actions. It's kind of like the slipstream of the Dhamma. So that's where when we practice and we have those conditions in place, then, you know, we don't suffer at that time because we're on the happy and easy path. You know, we're inspired by the Buddha's teachings. So even though you're in a world of suffering and you have those conditions in place, and even if it's just sometimes in the day you're correcting the path, just that process of applying ourselves again and again, it means we're lessening our suffering. And then I can't remember the simile for the first level of enlightenment, but it's like the, you know, the whole of the earth compared to like a pinch of soil. Now that's how much suffering you put down when you realize the first stage of enlightenment. And so these are like profound things. And not trifling matters. And then the last one is consciousness. And so consciousness is arising with contact. So whenever there's a thought or a sight or a sound or any impression, cognition is there. So cognition is just the element of knowing. And it's arising and ceasing with every moment of experience. And so it's just an element. As the Buddha said, it's like two magicians, a magician or a magician's apprentice at a crossroad, and you go and watch them. You know, first you might think it's a great, you know, magic, and then you watch it a few times and you realize it's just a trick. You know, it's insubstantial, there's nothing really there, it's fake. And so this is like consciousness. Even though consciousness is luminous, consciousness is amazing, in and of itself, it's just an element. And if we attach to that as some kind of eternal self, some kind of eternal happiness, then it will be a block in our practice. And so the Buddha teaches us even to see consciousness as a barb, like a barbed wire fence. So form is like attaching the form blindly is like a barb, attaching the feeling blindly is like a barb. Attaching to labels blindly is like a barb. Attaching to volition blindly is like a barb. Attaching to consciousness blindly is like a barb. But if we don't attach to these things, then they are just what they are. They're arising and ceasing on their own. So then we're not going to create additional suffering. And then all we have to do is apply ourselves to the Eightfold Path. And so the first two similes, which I said before, so form is like a bit of foam on the river Ganges. You know, you get a clump of white foam. So that's like form. If you think of our body, it's like a clump of white foam. There's nothing really there. It's just floating down the river and one day it will vanish. And if you look at it really closely, it's kind of in the process of change and alteration. And feeling is like when a drop of rain falls on the river Ganges and a bubble appears. And the bubble arises for a time. Like I was watching out the back here the other day when it was raining. And if you watch puddles when it's raining, you can see this. And the bubble will appear, arise for a while, and then it will cease. And so this is where we teach ourselves. Say you're meditating, you've got a painful feeling in your body. You can just imagine this bubble arising, and there it is on the surface of the water for a while, and then it'll pop. It'll go out on its own. Or the best happiness you've ever had in your meditation might arise, and you might want to cling to that. And you just see it as a bubble that arises, it's there for a while, and it'll pop, it'll cease. Or an indifferent feeling, a feeling of boredom, a feeling of neutrality. Right? It's just a bubble that arises and eventually it'll cease. And so these five khandhas, these are the things that we cling to as self. So, and this is the fundamental problem that causes the suffering. Because we cling to these things as me and mine, as us and them, as, you know, my possessions, their possessions, even cling to them as the elements, you know. Because of that, our minds don't find peace. And then when things change in a way that we don't want them, you know, we're not happy about it. And even forgiveness, we can see, you know, really if somebody's shouting at us or throwing stones at us, you can just contemplate, you know, well, if this body is just a clump of foam, you know, and they're just throwing a clump of foam at me, what am I really getting angry at? You know? And so when you start to look at our mental states, you know, it's just our mind wants to get angry. You know, our mind wants to be greedy. Our mind wants to be miserly. You know, our mind wants to be arrogant. And all of these things, they're just bad tendencies of our minds, but they don't serve us. And so why I went into this in detail today is this is something I've contemplated a lot over the years. And so sometimes, you know, in our meditation, yes, we develop meditation to develop peace. But once we have some peace, we can also contemplate. And so having something like these five khandhas and those similes that I mentioned today, just contemplating them, that's also practicing meditation. That's also developing wisdom. And so as thoughts come up, you could just apply any of those similes to a thought, and it would put some space between you and that thought. It would give birth to wisdom. And so it's usually that people don't have strength of mind to be able to sustain those thoughts. But ultimately, it's when we get interest in the Dhamma that then, you know, it's a cause for us to practice more. And even though it's not even in the greater discourse of mindfulness, where the Buddha goes through all the ways of being mindful, I don't think it's there. I did find a teaching once where the Buddha said contemplating the five aggregates is developing mindfulness and clear comprehension. You know? So basically any contemplation that we can sustain that we find interesting, and we won't know if it's interesting until we've contemplated it, you know, at least 10 or 20 times. Because until something's a habit, you know, we won't know whether our mind is keen on it or not. And so this was more a talk on, you know, how to develop some wisdom, because from the very beginning of my practice, I would supplement my meditation with contemplation. So you know, I do recommend also finding ways. As I said on Sunday, I read a little excerpt from Lumpo Te Ajahn Te, and he was talking about fighting. You know, somebody was asking, explaining his meditation experience, and Lumpo Te was mentioning that, you know, we need to fight the sense objects. You know, if we have calm in our mind, and we have the ability to fight off our thoughts, to fight off our memories, and that's what we do in the meditation, we fight them. But if we don't yet have strength of mind to fight those thoughts, those sense impressions, then, you know, we return to our calm object. And so this is the process of developing samadhi, because whether we're fighting off sense impression or thoughts, or whether we're developing calm, you know, we're developing samadhi, and we're developing a stronger mind. We're teaching our mind that proliferation is not the way, and doing whatever it wants is not the way. And yeah, so that's a rather detailed talk. So we have time for a meditation. Is there any questions? before we start?
The only thing I was going to say is that when it comes to giving,
yeah,
I always thought you never give it before it hurts. So giving is all about giving before it hurts.
Yeah. The Buddha had a very, can never remember if it was a quarter or a fifth. But basically, you know, you had one portion for your family, one portion for your business, one portion for saving for a rainy day. I think one portion, I can't remember, for some other group, like giving to friends and things. And then, or maybe it was your house. And the last portion was giving to the Sangha and stuff. So it's quite an extreme amount of giving, actually. And then even then, even though the Buddha so radically encourages people to give, then he teaches us also that even a moment of loving kindness meditation is better than all the giving. Like a pure loving kindness. So on one hand, by the time a person has that mind, they're going to be somebody who's already giving a lot anyway. And so if you're living in the world, giving is just a way of, you know, supporting the homeless and supporting the monks and nuns and people who can't support themselves. And so it's a form of sacrifice. And then the meditation is the next level of sacrifice, where we're actually starting to truly train the mind. So yeah, good point. So we'll do meditation. If you wouldn't mind just turning the light down there. Okay, so just start by getting ourselves in a comfortable position. I usually have a standard posture for meditating. We'll start by relaxing the body, the earth, the water, the fire, the wind. Hard stuff, the liquid stuff, the heat and the motion coming together in space. And just relax this whole body. Sure, the body is relaxed deeply. Doesn't mean it needs to be perfect, just accept it as it is. Of the head down to the soles of the feet, back up again. Just ensure the eyes are relaxed as well. Special importance to the eyes. It's also a place of our spiritual eyes, either stuck in the five hindrances, seeing clearly the seven factors of awakening, makers of blindness or makers of vision. Just relax the eyes deeply. Relaxed. We look at the mind. Give up all the outflows, the asavas, past, the future, sense objects. We set up a mind of renunciation and seclusion. Now's the time just to put everything down. Have a meditation object, now's the time to bring it up. I'll give a brief meditation on the breath, guided meditation for anybody who wishes. If you'd like a mantra, you could use the word Buddha, put with the in-breath, do with the out-breath. Particularly if mind has a tendency to proliferate. And choose a point of contact that's comfortable, such as the tip of the nose or the upper lip, the heart or the abdomen. Some place to settle the mind that is comfortable. In the center of the torso. Be aware of the sensations of an in-breath coming in and an out-breath going out. Know there is an in-breath. Know there is an out-breath. Sustaining our chosen means. They're like moving a pencil across a piece of paper. See if we can be aware of all the features of an in-breath, all the features of an out-breath. Tranquilize, bring a sense of tranquility to the bodily formations of the in-breath and the out-breath, so that everything settle into peace. I'm still and calm. sustain this calm, the full awareness of the breath, the rest of the meditation. I'll be silent for the next 15 minutes. see the benefit of meditating, benefit of being peaceful, taking the time to be with the causes, a calm mind, powerful mind. Chance. Now let us chant the verses assuring in aspiration through the goodness that arises from my practice. May my spiritual teachers and guide to great virtue, my mother, my father, and my relatives, the sun and the moon, and the more virtuous leaders of the world, may the highest gods and evil forces, celestial beings, guardian spirits of the earth, and lord of death, may those who are friendly, indifferent or hostile, may all beings receive the blessings of my life. May they soon attain the threefold bliss and realize the deathless through the goodness that arises from my practice and through this act of sharing. May all desires and attachments quickly cease, and all harmful states of mind, until I realize Nirvana, and every kind of birth. May I have an upright mind, with mindfulness and wisdom, austerity and vigor. May the forces of delusion not take hold, nor weaken my resolve. The Buddha is my excellent refuge, unsurpassed is the protection of the Dharma. The solitary Buddha is my noble lord, the Sangha is my supreme support. Through the supreme power of all these, may darkness and delusion be dispelled. Sagaram, Ivang Eva Yodinang Petanamu Pagapati Chitang Patitang Tung Panki Pameva, Samitatus Veprentus Angapa Chando Panara Soyata, Manichotira Soyata, Svitio Viva Chantu, Sabaruko Ina Satumate. Avantvantarayo sukhiti kayukopavo apivadana sili sani changuta pachayino chataro dhamma vadanti ayuvano sukham palam. Peace for evening.